So, welcome everyone to, is it the second SIPL seminar this term?
Who's again?
So it was Naomi Hawkins. I was not able to attend.
I don't know. Anyways, this is one of many SIPL seminars for this term. So good to see you guys here, and I'm very happy to present Alex Peukert. Alex is not only a former colleague from the Max Planck Institute, where we had, I think, an overlap of about 2 years, perhaps three or four years. Yeah. So I got to know Alex back then, 12 or so years ago. And Alex has, after he left the Max Planck, got a chair at Frankfurt University, where he still is. He was appointed in a very sort of high profile, I think, very interesting research cluster on normative orders, right? And he focused on intellectual property and international intellectual property in that context. And later on, he has also done a lot of work on the ontology of intellectual property. So the presentation he's going to give us now relates to that. And me and Alex and I had a discussion earlier about what actually ontology means. So I had a probably wrong conception of that term, but I understand it's essentially not about the reason for something to exist, but the existence itself. So we're looking at the existence of the things we are protecting under intellectual property, in particular copyright here. And I think I'll leave the rest to you and Alex to explain to us. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Henning. And thank you for the invitation and for taking the time to listening to this. My talk has two parts. The first part is very concrete. I will summarize a decision of the German Federal Supreme Court on a case that concerned the destruction of an artwork. And then I will try to use this example for this strange question of what is the mode of existence, if I may say so, of the copyright subject matter. Yeah? The work, what does that mean? So there's a concrete part and a more theoretical part to it, and I hope that the first part will show that it is a useful question to ask what do we mean with the work, because I have the impression that it's quite difficult to show that this is a useful question in the first place. So does it advance our understanding of the law to ask in what way we can make sense of the work? What is its mode of existence? Okay, but let's start with this case. It concerns an artwork which is called H. O. von Mannheim, or was called, because it doesn't exist anymore in this form. I mean, on the left side, you can see a picture of that museum, and on the the right side. And on the left side, you see a drawing of the artist. The idea was that this huge museum in Mannheim, which is in the southwest of Germany, has several floors. And the artist had the idea to put holes into each floor so that natural light would come through those holes from the top. And on the bottom, there was a laser light going upwards, and that should somehow give you an idea of the planet even. So it's a rather elaborate idea that Mrs. Behrens sort of pursue here. What you can see here is one of those holes. Someone is watching at it so that people won't fall in. And perhaps that was already the problem, because she clearly had the idea, you can't see this, that 2006, unlimited time to exist, right? The idea was this is a work for eternity. It's not time limited. It will remain in this museum forever. But already 1 year later, the museum started to remove this. I don't know what the reasons were. Perhaps it's simply too dangerous, or the people having to watch the visitors were too expensive. Anyhow, in 2007, they started to remove it, and eventually the whole museum was taken down. The floors were removed, and thus necessarily also this installation was removed, right? And the artist then sued the museum. Firstly, the first claim was to stop the removal when they noticed that the museum simply moved on. The claim was to build the museum anew and have the installation in that building again. And the third claim, a subsidiary claim, was for damages, right? If the museum, if that was to be found unproportionate, then at least damages would be due. Because, and that's the legal basis for all of that, the artist claimed contractual basis, I leave that aside, she claimed that's a violation of her moral right to integrity of the work. And that's the German version of Article 6b of the Berne Convention. The author has the right to prohibit the distortion or any other derogatory treatment of his work which is capable of prejudicing his legitimate intellectual or personal interests in the work. So you might wonder, how can you find for a violation of this provision in this very case? But the Bundesgerichtshof, so the highest civil court in Germany, found roughly 1 year ago that indeed the destruction of an artwork can amount to a violation of the right to integrity of the author. And here are the arguments in favor of this result. So section 14 can apply. The court reasoned, well, that is a derogatory treatment because treatment is extremely broad. It includes distortion, but it covers any other derogatory treatment. And since treatment, in contrast to the UK law, is not defined, we can also subsume here the destruction of an exemplar. Second argument, the removal cuts the intellectual bond between the author and the work, right? That's the German idea that the personality is reflected in the work, and if you destroy the work, then you know, kind of, you kill the baby. So with that argument, the court applied the requirement that the treatment is capable of prejudicing his or her intellectual or personal interests in the work. So already quite some application work done here. The third argument finally was section 14 allows for the necessary balance between the fundamental rights of the property owner on the one hand and of the author on the other hand, who relied here on her freedom of the arts, was the claim, right? So the court reasoned we should apply section 14 because this is a good way to find for a balance between all these interests that are conflicting here, the property owner, the museum on the one hand, and the artist on the other hand. And well, I read it as an argument. This is simply a nice way to come to a sensible conclusion. And what the court here applies is the requirement of legitimate, right? It has to be a prejudice to a legitimate interest. And in the word legitimate is covered all this balancing of interests. Do the interests of the property holder trump the interests of the author? So now, okay, these are the three paragraphs with the reasons given for, in principle, applying section 14. I have not yet said that the court has found for an infringement of the rule. The interesting and groundbreaking aspect of this decision is that the court for the very first time held that section 14 can apply at all to a destruction of an artwork. Before, all courts have said, no, the destruction of a work is not a treatment, right? But this has now been overruled, and the law is that section 14, the right to integrity, can apply. But look, there is one more requirement here, or some parts of the wording are missing, and now that gets me to my topic. What is treated here, right? The work is treated. And interestingly enough, in the decision, there is no definition of the work. There's no paragraph on that. The court simply talks about in various ways of the work. Sometimes the court refers to the exemplar. Sometimes the court refers to, you know, the abstract work. The court also speaks of the existence of the work. So I find some comfort in that reference. So apparently at one point or the other, and that's a point I want to make tonight, you can't avoid the question, in what way, what are you talking about? What does it mean, work in this provision? Now, you can level a number of critiques against this decision. In a case note, I have firstly argued that the destruction of an object, I still believe, cannot properly be called its treatment. I have difficulties to understand this. And if I read section 82A of the CDPA, I feel that this is reflected in the wording of the UK law, where treatment means any addition to, deletion from, or alteration or adaptation of the work, with some minor exceptions. And that, as I also learned from Lionel's textbook, doesn't include destruction, right? Isn't a treatment under that definition. The second point of critique is more fundamental, because the court leaves open the question, what precisely is treated here? I would argue that any definition of treatment is doesn't make any sense if you don't add what is treated, right? I mean, if you simply argue treatment is very broad, it covers more or less any activity, right? I mean, that can't be correct. You have to say what is treated. And here the dominant ontology, understanding of the subject matter of copyright, runs into problems. Because either you relate the treatment to the exemplar, right, to the installation in the building. That is called the token in contemporary philosophy. But the problem here is the token, the exemplar, the installation, is not the subject matter of copyright. The tangible exemplars or copies are not the subject matter of copyright, including moral rights. Instead, copyright relates to the intellectual property, which is just embodied in this instantiation, but there are other instantiations or embodiments, like, you know, the picture, possibly, or the drawing. The work hasn't been destroyed in the abstract sense, I would argue, and also the plaintiff seems to argue along these lines, because she argues that it is possible to have that exemplar again, so you need some other copies on which to rely. So the work exemplar can't be that what is treated. But also the abstract work, if you take it seriously, doesn't really fly here, because if you take it seriously, the abstract work, and the philosophical technical term would be type, you would have to say that you can't destroy or even treat in any way an abstract object by destroying just one token, right? I mean, if you delete the copy of this lecture, which is saved on Henning's drive here, then my lecture, if you assume that this already fulfills the work threshold, isn't destroyed. It continues to exist. In particular, if you think that it's a truly abstract entity, right? Those who address the issue at all would argue an abstract work is abstract in the sense that it is completely detached from any instantiations, right? It's not the same. It's just an embodiment in this instantiation or in another, but the work as such is intellectual, abstract. Critique speaks of a fiction, right? The critics argue that's a fiction, but they buy the argument that this fiction is not to be is not the same as one exemplar or several exemplars. So the standard understanding of the subject matter of copyright isn't helpful in answering the question, what is treated here? Because neither the exemplar nor the abstract type really gives you a sufficient answer. So an alternative understanding of the work is required, I would say, to make sense of this decision, right? The decision itself I can't really answer the question. Has the work been destroyed? Well, this institution, but the work as such apparently continues to exist because the copyright also continues to exist, right? Okay, what's the alternative understanding? I again refer to Kant's writing on the unlawfulness of reprinting of 1785, where Kant, as many of you will know, argued that you know the prohibition of reprinting can be explained on the basis not of an object that is owned, but on the basis of a regulation of speech, right? So Kant argued, we regulate speech, that's the opera, not the opus, the work, and copyright is a regulation of communicative activity. Drasinova, I would say, picks up on this argument in his book 2015, where he actually says, that the subject matter of copyright ought to be understood not as a commodity, but as a communicative act. Okay, this, I believe, is useful in making sense of that decision, because the decision sometimes refers to this approach, I would say, in passing, in a way. It says, for example, that this provision protects the intellectual and personal interest of the author to influence the cultural and societal communication process. That's my translation. And to live on in the work, right? So they have this understanding. So they argue Section 14 neither protects the token nor this abstract fiction, but it protects the interest of the author to influence public communication with the work. Okay? This interest to influence the cultural and societal communication via the work is prejudiced if you remove the only instantiation of that work which was actually built. And I think on this basis, you can make sense of the decision. The question would then be, does the destruction of an exemplar distort the communicative integrity of the work? Okay. And you immediately see that it is a kind of monstrous proposition to say the destruction of an exemplar of any work is possibly a violation of the moral right of integrity. Because again, if you delete an electronic copy of a text, this in no way distorts the communicative integrity and an interest of an author to live on in the work, I would say. Yeah. Instead, my suggestion would be to make a sense of this new theory, that one applies a distinction that was developed by philosopher Nelson Goodman some 40 years ago, where he distinguishes between allographic and autographic works in particular. I don't know whether you know about this. So autographic works are paintings in particular, where you would say there's just one Mona Lisa, right? Even a perfect copy is not genuine. It's a fake. Whereas a digital copy of a text is considered a true copy. And the performance of a musical score is original insofar as it or is considered a true copy, irrespective of the score that you use, right? Of whether you use the original score or another score, doesn't matter. These are allographic works where billions of copies are considered true copies, whereas paintings are the prime example where you essentially only have one original. And all other copies are not true copies. Yeah? Architecture is interesting in that Goodman seems to have difficulties to decide into which category it falls. On the one hand, you have the architect's plans according to which you can build the stuff. Also, this installation could be there could be a repeated building where this would be integrated. On the other hand, he says, well, the building is located at a certain place in Mannheim, for example, in a museum with a certain purpose, and therefore it's more like an autographic work. The very one installation in Mannheim was the only true one, and thus it has a special status, that exemplar. Good. I would argue that this distinction is useful in applying the new rule, and I would claim that only autographic works can trigger Section 14, like the destruction of a painting or of that building here, because these exemplars have a particularly important communicative impact. Through them, the author tries to show how this idea, this concept of these holes works, how visitors deal with it. And thus, if you remove this installation, you make it virtually impossible for the author to influence the public communication through the work. So this is a very rare case where I would say Section 14 can apply. And this is another criticism towards the decision, because the decision says Section 14 applies in every case of a destruction of a work. And this goes way too far, right? I mean, and I would cut it back to those rare scenarios, if at all. And also, you still have the interests of the owner. You still have the interest of the museum, and if you consider the interest of the museum to modernize the exhibition rooms, then you come to the conclusion Section 14 is not infringed, right? So much noise about nothing, also another criticism towards this decision. Why do you open up the box of Section 14 in the first place if you don't come to the conclusion that it is infringed at the very end? So I find it overreaching in many, many respects, because I have not yet seen in German jurisprudence a case where the author really had the right to stop the removal of, let's say, train station or museums or churches. It's very often those cases, right? This is the architecture case. I have presented it firstly, to show to you how far German moral rights can possibly go, but secondly, also to show to you that in some cases it's really difficult to avoid a position towards the question, what do you mean with work, right? You have to present a consistent understanding of the work. Now, I have presented this here with a communicative integrity, right? The work as speech. But I find it still unclear. What is it that communicates? Is it the abstract work, the exemplar, both, or is it the author? What does it mean that a text communicates? I find this still a bit strange and not very clear, or loose, you could also say. Thus, I take the liberty to present to you my alternative ontology, or my proposal to understand the subject matter of intellectual property, and I will limit this here to copyright. So there's a German book, a translation is underway, and it will be published with Cambridge University Press probably next year. In a nutshell, these are three of my heroes, right? And you might know one or the other. In particular, Elizabeth Anscombe should be known in Cambridge. Alfros is a Scandinavian legal realist. Tutu is his most famous work in the Harvard Law Review. And he wrote in 1945 a review in Danish, which is unfortunately not translated into English, where he already, I'm just repeating what he already said. but it's now in German. Also, I believe he was very influential for the Scandinavian discussion. It's still ongoing. In a second, for example, Ole Andreas Rongstad, a colleague from Oslo, has published a book 2 years ago, Property Aspects of Intellectual Property, where he takes up this discussion again. Based on some discussion with me, refers already to some ideas that I'm trying to put forward. Anyhow, so Alf Ross triggered a big discussion on how to make sense of the subject matter of this strange new body of law, intellectual property. But he only, in my view, leveled a negative critique in saying intellectual property, the subject matter is a fiction, right? What is that supposed to be mean? He is criticizing the German doyen of intellectual property, Josef Kohler, who invented Immaterialgüterrecht, immaterial good. Josef Kohler created this notion of immaterial good out of thin air, and then said immaterial good is the object of that new exclusive right. And Alf Ross said, well, that's transcendental nonsense in a way. What are you actually regulating here? But Ross didn't really submit a useful alternative approach to understanding the subject matter of that law that is in force, right? We have the law, and I'm not denying that the law is in force. Elizabeth Anscombe is a philosopher who lived in Cambridge for many years. She introduced the distinction between brute facts and institutional facts in a short paper some 70 years ago, where she distinguished potatoes from the promise to pay for potatoes. Okay. And then you have another hero of mine, John Searle, the only one still alive on this slide, who is a philosopher at the University of Berkeley, who wrote a number of books on social ontology, developing, you know, analytic philosophy further. Now, I'm just applying what these people have said to intellectual property. To my knowledge, no one has done that. So that is the little potential contribution here. As I already said, there is still some interest. Alexandra George's book, Constructing Intellectual Property, also addresses the issue, although she remains on the mainstream track, I would say. She merely says, well, it's an abstract object, it's a type, and then that type is allocated via ownership rights to someone. Good. Now, what in perhaps 10 more minutes or 15? What's the alternative? The basic belief is there is only one world and one cognition, right? And that one world is made up at the end of the day out of particles, some matter, right? There is not a second world or even a third world, but there's just one world, and we have to explain all reality in this holistic manner. But clearly we have to distinguish between between two types of matter. What you can't see here is brute facts. One type of matter is brute fact. What's a brute fact? Brute fact is something that you can measure, that science can measure. You can measure potatoes. You can measure a book. You can measure a digital file on a computer. You can make it visible. You can also measure brain activity. You can measure human activities. So a performance on stage. A performance on stage is a brute fact. Now, these brute facts are not in and of themselves the subject matter of intellectual property. Instead, intellectual property belongs, as all law, to the other ontological category, and these are institutional facts. Institutional facts can't be measured by scientific methods, Instead, they are facts created through language. And this is where analytic philosophy, the philosophy of language, comes in, because these philosophers have explained how, via language, humans are able to create social realities. Law is a social reality. It's based completely, it exists in language. It's expressed through language, and it's a human a construct via language and implemented or expressed via language. So this is no question that law is an institutional fact. My question is where to locate the copyright subject matter, right? Where does it fit in this ontological framework? And you already see that the dominant paradigm would have to give the answer, well, our subject matter is not a brute fact as this desk or as a piece of land in real property law, but instead it's an institutional fact. The work is an entity that only exists because we speak and think that it exists as an entity. It just exists in our language. That's the point. So already the subject matter falls into this difficult constructed category of institutional facts. And that's the huge difference to real property law, right? And that's also what Ola Andreas tries to point readers to. The huge difference is that real property law has a brute fact as subject matter, whereas IP has this constructed subject matter as its object. Good. Now, if you continue along these lines, the dominant IP ontology clearly says, no, that subject matter is not a brute fact, but it's an abstract object. And I show in the book this is an understanding and way of speaking that only emerged in the 18th century. And I mean, I'm not the person to put this forward here, but as Lionel and others have shown in their writings, UK copyright law in particular has had a long time to go until it finally reached, you know, the abstract object as the subject matter. The work as the subject matter was only introduced in the 19th century, as far as I could find out, via an international treaty. Before, one spoke about, you know, copying of books, maps, charts, what have you. But this very abstract language also entered only via France after the French Revolution. So that's the dominant idealist IP ontology, but that doesn't work in our case. And I have other examples where you can show its failure to explain the law as it stands, right? It's insufficient to describe the law as it stands. And that's, I believe, the usefulness of an alternative approach. Now, what's the alternative approach? I would call that a legal realist approach, where you don't end with this fiction, but you continue to argue which artifacts and which activities do you actually regulate. The work then is understood differently. It has a different meaning. It doesn't relate to an abstract object somewhere in world two or three that no one has ever seen, but it's just a general term for a multiplicity of sufficiently similar artifacts, right? We speak in that way, and that makes sense, but it's only a general term that relates to the real world, not to some abstract world somewhere. I submit that copyright and other IP laws should be understood as regulating the use of certain artifacts. I will introduce my suggestions, master artifacts and secondary artifacts, in a second. In summary, copyright would then be understood not as a property right in an object, but as an exclusive right to authorize or prohibit what? to prohibit certain uses of the master artifact. Now, what's the master artifact? The master artifact is the artifact, the manuscript or the drawing or what have you, that the author has declared to be the subject matter. And that's the speech act, the declarative speech act. The author writes something and then declares, perhaps by saving it on a computer or sending it to the publisher, this is the original, this is the master artifact, which is then the point of reference of all further activities, because this is not where copyright stops. Sometimes certain uses of the master artifact are regulated, for example, exhibition, right? I don't know about the UK law, but in German law, exhibition only applies to the original if it was not published before. So some uses are regulated specifically for the master artifact. And all the rest is the production and further use of what I call secondary artifacts, including personal performance. Secondary artifacts are copies that are sufficiently similar, right? And again, you see that's already a normative decision to say this artifact is sufficiently similar and thus I consider it infringing. So it's a different way of approaching the practice of intellectual property law, and certainly the question is this useful, right? Does it advance our understanding of anything at all? I would say yes. And I have my case here where I would say, instead of just refusing to apply the word work in that provision, refuse a definition, just confuse, you know, the exemplar and the abstract type, one should be serious about this requirement and define what it means. And I've tried to make an argument here. I would say a Section 14 can only apply if the master artifact is at stake, and that master artifact is an autographic artifact where only one exists. So paintings would be the prime example, buildings already a bit difficult, and then in addition it has to be a significant master artifact that does have an influence on public communication. You know, if it's just a everyday little painting, that would already not suffice for an infringement of the moral rights. And my final example for the significance of that theory is if you compare UK copyright with German Urheberrecht. And I would say UK copyright displays many features of what I would call a physicalist jurisdiction, right? It's a jurisdiction that is still shows many traces of the privilege type of thinking. Copyright speaks for itself. For example, in Section 80, you see how precisely treatment is defined, because my claim would be that law is still kind of concerned with these artifacts, with the question, which activity do I regulate, right? Whereas German copyright is totally abstract. It has an abstract work concept, which has an open definition. It's not a closed list, like on paper at least, currently in the UK, is a closed list of work categories. Not so in Germany. We have an open list of exclusive rights. So exclusive rights are unlimited in theory. It's not a definite list of activities that the right holder can control. And I would claim one reason for this is the strong reliance on these very abstract concepts that allow you to simply say, well, the subject matter is the work, and whatever that might be found to be. And that is where I think this is most useful, namely in the descriptive explanatory realm, right? I would claim that this theory is better in explaining the functioning of today's IP law. And I could perhaps, if we have a debate, also bring up further examples. Because it's always about comparing artifacts, right? Before the court. I mean, you are not discussing about abstract work concepts. You are actually dealing with concrete artifacts, clearly. But since we are lawyers, we also need some normative implications. It would be useless, I believe, and not helpful if it wouldn't have any normative implications. And I do think it does have normative implications because it invites or implies a fundamental change of perspective, namely from property in fictional objects to privileges to act regarding certain artifacts. Yeah? And very clearly one comes back to a thinking which is the mainstream in Europe until the French Revolution, and that alternative ontology reminds us that it is possible to regulate IP subject matter in the way to speak of privileges to act, you know what I'm referring to. But this is not only, you know, a perhaps dubious reference to former times. I'm certainly not claiming, you know, let's go back to absolutist privileges. Clearly not. But I'm claiming if you focus on this regulatory effect, I would argue that this implies a leveling up, elevating, raising justification requirements. I believe perhaps best example are adaptations, right? The work concept was introduced, and you can show also in Germany, when it came to translations and any other adaptations. Because then you can't speak of reprinting or copying anymore. That doesn't work. You need a new concept to cover these altered versions. At this occasion, the work concept came into play and was used to then argue, well, but it may be a translation, but the meaning of the work can be found in that translation, or the plot can be found, or certain characters can be found. Yeah, and in German law, it was held that a sequel of a novel is a violation of the adaptation right. So someone writes a sequel to a novel, is complete, the wording is not copied at all. Well, you copy some characters, but you could argue, do you copy characters in a fictional novel if you write a new sequel? It's a different character. But nevertheless, that was found to be covered by copyright. You need a license to write a sequel of a book. I think that this goes quite far. It was reasoned on the basis, well, the work is very abstract, and here certain important elements not clearly defined are used, and there are certain reasons to protect the copyright owners. There may be reasons, but if you adopt this alternative perspective, you would the defendant could say, look, but my artifact is really, really different from yours, and you need strong arguments to prohibit me from using this different artifact that I have created with my resources. You have to show very good arguments for that. And I believe that would perhaps make a bit of a difference. And with that, I thank you for your kind attention.